Okay, let's begin today's session then. You will notice immediately that I am not alone at this end of the table. You all seem a bit further away today. I'm not quite sure how that's happened. Maybe just my eyesight's getting worse. But I'm joined at the top here by Louise and Moose, who are third year PhD students. As you're aware, they're coming as a big favour to me, for which I thank them very much. They're coming today to share with you some of their experiences about going on fieldwork. So we've reached the fourth of our sessions on research design, and we will be looking today at fieldwork in general. The first hour, Louise and Moose will be here, and so we will focus primarily on what it means to be a PhD student out in the field, conducting research. They've got some wonderful stories to tell. I'm sure some of those stories will worry you slightly about what you will be letting yourself in for. But to be forewarned is very definitely to be forearmed. There are any number of things that happen when you're away on fieldwork that you are not expecting, that you really wish didn't happen, and that you have to respond to as and when they do arise. And there's nothing you can do to prepare yourself for that. You can cover as many eventualities as you can imagine at the preparation stage, but it still doesn't mean that everything will go as smoothly as you were hoping for it to go. So it takes quite a lot of, I think, bottle as much as anything to continue to try to conduct your fieldwork research when things are not going quite as well as you hoped they were going to. The temptation must always be to just run away and come back home and try to find a different way to do your PhD. But perseverance is often the key in this respect. Let me open it straight away to Louise and Moose. Do you have any opening observations you want to make, or do you just want to tell us a few anecdotes about the things that have happened to you when you have been on field work? I presume it's the element of surprise when things go wrong that is the most destabilising and the most difficult to respond to.
Yeah, I think, Matt, we thought what we would do is do two things, is cover some of the practical things to think about, because there are a lot of practicalities just to organise before you go and make sure you've thought of, so you're not caught unawares when you are wherever you are. And then we thought we would just share some of our stories with you, but we wanted to leave time for your questions as well. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are planning to do field work as part of your PhD? That's a lot. Okay. Good. So we thought I would start, and then I'd hand it over to Moose.
Maybe we can have a show of hands again at the end of the first hour to see whether they're still planning on doing it.
Yeah, exactly. My field work took place in Geneva, where I did a lot of interviews with people in UN organizations. And then I also spent 2 months in Malawi interviewing anybody who would agree to speak with me and traversing the country in various modes of transportation to get to these meetings. There's a lot of sort of administrative stuff that goes with preparing with field work. I mean, first you have to figure out who the best people are to talk to. They're not always the most senior people. Sometimes the next level down is better because A, they've got the time, and B, they might be a little more forthcoming than somebody who is more of a politician or a spokesperson for their organization. So understanding your wish list is important. Knowing if you can get any kind of introduction from your supervisor, from another member of staff here, somebody you did your master's with, like really looking at, is there any way I can put in the subject line of an introductory email, I am contacting you at the suggestion of Professor Matthew Watson, or any link that you can have is helpful. What I did mostly is sent an email introduction that was very to the point. I asked for the interview within the first sentence because busy people do not read emails. And it was also clear who I was in the subject line, which, you know, also runs the risk of getting sent to the delete file as well, but that's life. The middle paragraph was always a little bit about my research, and I always had a link to my e-portfolio, which I made sure I kept up to date in case anyone was really needing to be distracted and wanted to surf the web. And then, you know, I would conclude with a plea about, you know, I know I'm just a poor little PhD student, but maybe you would really have time. So that's the introduction. I often had to do a follow-up phone call, sometimes several phone calls, and sometimes I many times would resend emails. Do not expect that you send an email and you get a response. That does happen, but I would say that is the exception rather than the rule. Before the meeting, I would send to them what I called a proposed agenda, so I would never be presumptive about, well, this is, you know, this is exactly what you're going to talk to me about. And in my case, what I did was organized a list of questions for them and made it clear, a few things that I made clear in the agenda, that they would not be cited directly, so that was in writing for them, that I would ask for permission to record the interview, and that I didn't expect we would cover the full agenda, but we could together basically choose what would be the best use of our time together, so that they felt they had some input into the discussion. After the meeting, I sent thank you notes promptly. You would be surprised how many people do not do that. And I also, if people's executive assistants were involved, I sent a thank you note to the executive assistant, because you never know when you're going to need something else, and the EA is your best friend. After the meeting, I actually recorded all of my meetings, so nobody said no. How I would phrase it is, would you mind if I recorded this, because it really helps me with my notes and referrals? And then I would say, and, you know, I would reassure them that I would not be, you know, putting their name under something controversial that they would say. I transcribed verbatim all of my interviews, which was very helpful in writing up, because I could word search. I'd be like, okay, who? And in fact, at the end, what I did is created with themes a big Excel spreadsheet with the salient points. So if I was looking under Division of Labor and UN agencies, I had all my Division of Labor quotes, and I could easily find things. So organizing your materials after is important, or really helpful to do, because when you're writing, you do not want to be filtering through, you know, 80 hours of interviews. Someone told me, and I didn't use this, and I don't know if Muse knows this, but there is a tool available in the library called Dragon, and I think it's for people with disabilities, and that you put, it can actually change a recording into words. Had I known that, it would have saved me weeks. But apparently there's this tool. So I didn't use it. I just heard about it. But it's probably worthwhile investigating. So just as a word to the wise.
And if you need a note of introduction to the library, your supervisors can give that for you if you're asking them to be able to use this facility.
Yeah, I don't. I just sort of found out about it. You know, I had one of those kind of moments, like, you know, it would have saved me a lot of time. Although I have to say, transcribing I found quite useful, because I would re-list, because in the meeting I'm also taking notes, I'm thinking about the next question, I'm trying to get somebody to open up about something, I'm really looking at the flashing light on my recorder thinking, please dear God, like, don't fail me. So I have a lot going on in the meeting, so I'm not always taking everything in. So actually for me, transcribing was quite good, because I would listen to it again and go, that's good, you know, and I probably may not have picked that up in the moment, just because so much, you know, was going on. In terms of timing, sometimes I would be bold and ask for an hour of people's time, and sometimes I would get it. Mostly what I did is ask for 30 minutes. Sometimes was asked to keep it to 20. I had one person who was like, oh my, like, had no time to see me, and I knew she had this very, very important thing on her plate, and I actually felt pretty guilty that I was in her office at 7:30 in the morning and, you know, taking her time. She ended up getting so interested in the discussion, I actually, you know, an hour and 10 minutes into it, had to say, in good conscience, I need to, you know, not take any more of your time. So if you get people engaged, often because they don't get to talk about interest, you know, they don't get to talk about some of these more conceptual things about their work that isn't about, you know, a business meeting or getting something done. So sometimes you get people who get like really into, oh yeah, that's really, you know, and they da 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 da, and that's what you want, right? So you want people to feel relaxed and start to open up. In terms of actual other tactical things, and then I'll tell you some stories. If depending on where you're going, I didn't do this, but I think if you can get affiliated, especially if you're going to a developing country with a university or a research institute, that's helpful because you've got some local credibility. And somebody who knows something about the local environment. If I had to do it again, I would have tried harder to do that, and that takes lead time. So you need to really start to think about that now if you're going to try and create those relationships. And you'd be surprised at pockets of relationship that exist in this university that you're expected to, I don't know how you're expected to know about them, but contact the international office. The Institute of Advanced Studies, for example, has a Sub-Saharan African research network that we're both a part of. Like, fish around for stuff on campus. Look at the societies, because there's different country societies. Like, really try and see how you can build relationships with, you know, leverage anything Warwick has with another university or something. Because these things are very, in my opinion, not well communicated and not easy to find. So, you know, there's probably riches here that we could be using a lot better. In terms of actual travel abroad, things you need to obviously bring with you, your department business card. So if you don't have one, get one. Your supervisor can just sign off the form for you. So it's got the Warwick logo on it, and you can put the link to your research profile, etc., your address and all that stuff. We both got letters. I wrote mine, and Heather just put it on departmental letterhead and stamped Ben Rosman's signature on it. Is that being recorded? Yeah. basically saying, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing in the country. You know, so that if you're stopped by customs, by, you know, any, or immigration, anything like that, at least you've got something on you, you know, that you're a full-time student, blah, blah, blah. So you're legitimized. I ended up getting the office to fax me a signed copy of my ethics statement. I was challenged in a meeting because I did not have permission of the National Research Council from Malawi to be there. And I have to say, it was a bit of a gamble for me. If you're going to speak to government people, a lot of countries will ask that you have this. But if you apply for it, you also run the risk. You're a PhD student. You're not Johns Hopkins University doing a longitudinal study taking blood samples for HIV/AIDS. Like, you know, there's research and then there's research. And I was worried that I would get in some sort of bureaucratic, you know, lost file somewhere, have opened up the fact I was going, be easily identifiable, never get approval, and then have more difficulties because of that. So, again, if I were to do it again, I would probably, I'm not sure what I would do. I may do the same thing again, but I definitely got confronted at a meeting, and I sort of had one of these kind of like, they're going to kick me out of the country. It was not a very nice interaction. So you should look into what those things are. And in some, you know, like in Malawian websites, when you're in the country, actually the websites work quite well. If you're coming, they're not very stable. I don't know why. using, I guess, IP addresses outside of the country for whatever reason. So there were things that I was able to access more easily from a Malawian service provider than I could here. So it's part of the, I think, just infrastructure issues when you're in a developing country. Make sure you have health insurance. Make sure your health insurance includes evacuation, because if you need to get out and you need to be evacuated, it can cost you $50,000 to $100,000. I'll say dollars because I'm Canadian, but it can cost you a lot of money. So know what your insurance covers and make sure that you've got insurance for evacuation. Make sure you know what shots you need. Make sure you take your malaria meds. if you need yellow fever, you've got to have a special certificate. Make sure you know what the visa requirements are. To get in the country is one thing, but if you're staying often more than 30 days, sometimes you have to get that renewed and stamped, and you're not told that at the airport. Just things like that. I had instances, traveling on a bus at night in complete pitch darkness because none of the villages have electricity. And for whatever reason, there were all these roadblocks on this long trip, with guys with guns and fires burning by the roadside coming in and asking for documentation from basically the non-Malawians on the bus. It was a bit scary. So, just make sure that there's no reason that somebody could have a bureaucratic issue with your paperwork. So just investigate and just get a really good travel guide. Highlights and lowlights. I'll start with my low light, which was, well, there was a few, but one was making a second trip to Geneva because I really needed an interview with this one organization, getting the second in command to agree to speak to me, being in the lobby of the building. So I'm a self-funded PhD, so this is my money I'm spending, my personal hard-earned money. Being in the lobby of the building and getting a phone call from the guy's secretary canceling the meeting. That was just anyway. Certain thoughts ran through my head. So things like that happen. Probably one of the highlights, they were just some remarkably generous people. I had a guy who was responsible for raising $21 billion for the Global Fund, spend an hour with me. He had prepared ahead of the meeting. He thought about examples to illustrate his main points. Completely professional. It was just impressive. It was just really, and I just felt very respected, which was something. You see people's characters in all kinds of ways. There's definitely some disappointments, but definitely some really extraordinary people out there too. So
great. I had probably more highlights to my trip than Louise, I guess. And I guess that's one of the advantages of choosing my home country to do my fieldwork in. And it's probably too late now, but I would have said you should pick a country where it's nice and sunny so you could plan your trip around winter and then you could get some sunshine before coming back. But you probably already picked your country. And quite similar to Louise, I had to get a lot of administrative things sorted out. One of the things that I found really helpful was getting an introduction and validation letter from my supervisor, which he wrote himself. He put on his, because he's in CSGR, and he put it in CSGR letterhead and signed it. And I got sort of a brief overview of my research in bullet points, very straight to the point, saying what I wanted to do, the purpose of my visit, also in bullet points so it's easy to read. And I attached that. It was printed on department letterhead, and I had that attached to the letter from my supervisor. And I was able to get a contact person in Nigeria before leaving, and I wrote an introduction letter saying who I was, when I would be in the country, what I would like to do, and that I would like to have a meeting with them, had all of these scanned and emailed to someone who actually dispatched them to different places that I wanted to visit before I got there. So by the time I got there, I had all these stamped receipts, you know, of letters, and I would go up to these buildings and say, well, I brought this letter in, someone brought this letter in for you 2 weeks ago. I asked for a meeting. Will it be possible to see someone? You know, and usually they would open a big register and say, oh, yeah, that came in on this day. We'll see if this person's there. And people were really helpful, a lot more helpful than I thought they would be. So if the person I wanted to see wasn't there, they would say, okay, why don't you talk to this person instead? You know, or you, if you're really lucky, you would find someone, usually people who work in admin, who's really excited about the possibility of having some fancy person show up in the office to do research, and would say, oh, why don't you sit here? I'll check if this person's there, you know. And it's really, it can be really nice if you find someone like that. If you don't, you just have some, usually women in my case, look at you and go, well, the person's not here, why don't you just come back another day or something like that, which is not very nice. And so I found that really useful to have the contact in advance before my visit. So I had a lot of things set up. And then one thing I found very useful was when I had the meetings with people, at the end of it, I would ask them if they could suggest someone that they thought would be useful to talk to. You know, so it's sort of like a snowballing effect. So you speak to one person and he says, oh, you know, you could talk to this person. They'll give you a card or a contact number and say, just tell him, you know, you spoke to me, and they can get in touch. If you can get people to do that, you would be able to speak to people you wouldn't even expect. I ended up having about 8 to 10 interviews with people who I didn't even know would existed, you know, but they turned out to be a lot more useful than some of the people I contacted before I left. Yeah, and I found that very, very useful. And I think you just need to be really persistent, you know, because you have to be really patient. Never show any sort of, you know, oh, I have something better to do with my time. If you show up at the office and the person's not there, and usually they can't tell you when the person will be there, you don't know what the person looks like, a lot of things are going on around you, possibly languages you don't understand being spoken. You know, just sit there, really, look really calm, look really, you know, polite, and just sit there like you have all the time in the world. But then, you know, every now and then you go up to someone and say, you know, just to remind them that you're there, if it's not that obvious, which sometimes it doesn't seem to be. And I didn't use a dictaphone at all because I sort of got some advice from my supervisor, and because of the nature of the questions I was asking, because I was looking at a specific governance assessment in the country, and it was a sensitive time because there was lots of issues with presidential politics and stuff. So I thought if I use a dictaphone, people might be less willing to speak to me if they thought they were being recorded. So I made notes. And the thing about making notes is, you know, half the time you're writing and you're trying not to miss something. And sometimes you want to engage with them so they don't feel like you're not paying attention because you're scribbling. So it is quite difficult. But to do that, I found it very useful to have a very specific structure about what I was looking for in my interviews. So I had very specific themes. So when I asked my questions, whatever information I got, as soon as I left the meeting, I would sort of scribble on the side of my notes where it all fit in, you know. So it had codes like A, B, C, or D, so I knew exactly what everything was. So it wasn't, because they wouldn't exactly talk to you in the order of your questions, you know. They could just randomly say things and branch off into different things. And I found that very, very useful. Another thing I thought was interesting was the fact that I had one meeting that went on for over an hour and a half, and one meeting that was only about 15 minutes because the guy had to go. And I can say I probably got more out of 15 minutes than I did from an hour and a half, because he was just very interested in all the fancy ideas and stuff that I was talking about. As Louis said, you know, they like to talk about the conceptual things, they don't get to do that. You know, so he was sort of like all over the place, and not all of it was useful, but you know, most of the time I would pretend to be scribbling something down so he didn't think I wasn't interested in what he was saying. And sometimes it's not really the duration of the interview, but, you know, it depends on the individual and how well they communicate. And what else did I want to say? Yeah, I guess my highlights would be, you know, the fact that I was able to make contact with a lot more people than I anticipated, and that basically came from the generosity of the people that I spoke to, you know, and it was being able to be very clear. I mean, from the beginning, also about recording and stuff. From the beginning, I would say to them, "Well, I'm going to make notes. I'm not going to record this. If there's anything you want to say, you wouldn't like me to record, or you wouldn't want to be quoted on, just let me know." You know, you need to make them feel as comfortable as possible about the things that they're going to share with you. And I found that very useful. When they relax, you know, at the end of it, just say, "Who do you suggest I talk to?" And that is truly, truly helpful. And also, be, as Louise said, I can't overemphasize being thankful for just their time. You know, send an email to say a thank you for meeting, and also those administrative people, they're absolutely key. You know, keep in touch with them, especially if you're going to go back. I'm going to go back, so I've had to, you know, from time to time, send an email saying, "Oh, hello, how is everything?" You know, just keeping in touch, and hopefully see you on my next visit and things like that. You know, keep the contacts going. Low point would probably be being hit on by one of the people I was hoping to interview. Yeah, that was very uncomfortable. But altogether, it was a good experience, and it all comes down to the preparation. You know, if you've got all the paperwork ready, you've got your mind sort of ready for whatever comes, then, you know, hopefully things will go well.
Brilliant, thank you very much. Can I ask you, before I open it up to questions from everyone else, you came back off your fieldwork trips thinking that it had been worthwhile, that you'd created a really strong evidential base to help writing the empirical chapters for your PhD.
Yes, definitely. I have two trips to do, and this was sort of setting the framework. You know, I had to get very basic information for writing some chapters before the analytical chapters, and without the fieldwork, I wouldn't have been able to do that. You know, it filled a lot of gaps. So I had done all this desk research and gone to different websites, and what you find is, as she said, some of the websites you just can't find the information, or they're so out of date. And just going and speaking to people, you get that information. It's very, very useful.
I actually got a... It was near the end of my time in Malawi. I started to clue into something that I thought was pretty interesting that had been mentioned in interviews, and I thought, I wish I had known this before, and it's the kind of thing I would never have known had I not been there. And actually, I think it's going to make my PhD. I think it's going to make a really compelling argument in my PhD, and I was looking in a slightly different area, and, you know, that was sort of where I was focusing on, only because I didn't know any better. But I sort of, there was a little bit of serendipity there that I, you know, discovered things I would not have otherwise been privy to.
That is the huge payoff of fieldwork, though. It does allow you to find things out that you couldn't find out any other way. When you're talking to people and they're reflecting directly on their experiences, they are telling you things that are not in the public domain. They are telling you things that you cannot read about in the literature. The Warwick University Library, good as though it might be, in some instances, cannot provide you with the sort of information that you can find out for yourself on fieldwork. And that's why so many PhDs do have an important fieldwork component to them, because this is a way of really justifying the empirical focus of your PhD thesis, and of being able to do something distinctive and original within the empirical work that you do. Now, if I was understanding you two correctly, I think you were telling us that preparation is key, that it is the most vital thing, that you can't suddenly decide that you want to go on fieldwork next week, buy yourself a lastminute.com plane ticket and disappear. The fieldwork is something that you put in place over a number of months of preparation. Can you remember how long it took you to do all your preparation? It was months rather than weeks, though, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. takes time.
It's not something that you can do off the cuff. You need a strategy. You need to know who it is that it would be most useful for you to talk to. And even though you can usefully snowball your contacts when you are out there in the field, unless you have a sense of who it is that you want to go and talk to in the first place, you're not going to be able to take advantage of those snowballing tactics. Moose is absolutely right. The most important question to ask right at the end, often when they're very relaxed because you've turned the tape recorder off or you've put your pen down, depending how you've been taking notes, is to say to them, and who else would you recommend that I talk to? Mm-hmm. And they will often give you a whole list of people that it might be worthwhile you trying to contact. These are people that you probably didn't even know existed. You certainly had no information before that they were important to the policy process that you're looking at in the way that this person has just said they are. And of course, if you have a recommendation from one of your interviewees to go and contact a certain number of other people, then that's the first thing you tell these other people when you contact them. So-and-so, who's in charge of your department, says it would be particularly interesting for me to talk to you. And if you can then make it look as though one of their hierarchical superiors believes that you should be talking to them, it becomes much more difficult for them to say, no, I don't want to talk to you, thank you very much. So that might be slightly sneaky, but I think it's the way that you do usefully snowball your contacts when you are in the field. But preparation is vital before you get into the field. You can't simply turn up and just do it. You must have a strategy before you go there. Is there anything that you can do if you get let down, if your strategy doesn't look as though it's going to come to fruition? A lot of being on field work is about responding to events as they occur to you.
Well, I did some. I was tenacious. Some would say I was a stalker. So some of the tactics I used, just showing up at people's offices, trying to make friends with the EA, showing up at people's offices several times, getting personal mobile phone numbers. I was kind of like whatever it takes, baby. I need to get some representation from certain organizations. Not always successful. They have equally good tactics. Their tactics include come back, you know, later and all of that kind of stuff. He's up in the north part of the country. I had a meeting with someone, I got a meeting with this person, and I was like, you know, scored. You know, I'm in her calendar, 8 a.m., Monday morning, you know, figure out how I'm going to get there, because the minibuses don't start running for a certain time, and you have to wait till they're full, and, you know, so you got to kind of, so I was like, okay, so I get all the way there, and I get shown into her office, and she says to me, do you have a list of questions? And I had to say yes, because I did, and she said, you know, give them to me and I'll email you my answers, which of course she never did. Then I got the, do you have permission from the Research Council? And I pointed out I spoke to someone very senior in the top person in the president's office, who didn't seem to have a problem. And she said, well, if you have a personal letter from her, then I would speak to you. So I had someone be so rude to me on the phone that I was actually... I was like stopped in my tracks for a moment. I was just like, well, is there a member of your staff I could speak to? you have to be tenacious, and sometimes it seems a little dire, but you know, there's always somebody who will. You know, you just try again, or you try another organization, or you try another route, or it's just like, you got to keep going.
Yeah, I would say don't take it personal, whatever people do to you. Otherwise, you get really discouraged and really disheartened.
Mm-hmm.
And, I rang people up, and they wouldn't answer their phone. Or,
mm-hmm.
They would answer the phone, I would say who it is, and they would say, let me call you back. You know, and then obviously you know they wouldn't call you back, so I would ring people up and then I would send them a message and say, oh, it's me and I'm just trying to reach you, you know, and then I would ring them up again a couple of hours later and realize it would be really annoying, and then I would probably just show up at their office and sort of be really observant, because you don't know who you're looking for. And sometimes I find that a lot of the people who work at the front desk, it's almost like they instinctively say, oh, the person's not in, you know, even if the person is, you know, because they just feel that they should sort of protect the person from anyone who comes in, or if you don't look important enough, then they wouldn't let you see the person, you know. So I would try to be observant and see if there's anyone coming in who seems to be surrounded by people trying to get his attention, and wonder, oh, could that be the person that I'm waiting for? And then ask someone sitting next to me, oh, who's that? You know, just sort of, you know, be nice to people and try to find out things about. Yeah, but you just have to be persistent. Don't take it personally and just keep going until you can speak to someone.
Moose raises a very important point there, the point about gatekeepers. Presumably you only want to talk to people to help with your PhD research because they are in some sense important. But then we know what happens with important people. You don't get access to important people directly. You can't walk in off the street and knock on their door like you can knock on my door, which tells you something about how important I am in the larger scheme of things. All of the people that you will want to talk to will be squirreled away in a big building behind many desks and many locked doors and many people. There will be gatekeepers to them, gatekeepers to their diary, gatekeepers to their time. Any advice for how you deal with the gatekeepers? Is it just about trying to be charming, or are there tactics beyond that?
You can try being charming, but sometimes I find also, being a woman, it's very difficult if you come across an EA who's also a woman. You know, immediately they look at you, it's almost like you can feel this tension in the room, and you go, oh, I'm a PhD student from the University of Warwick, and they're like, so who do you think you are? Type thing, and almost try to go out of their way to make your life miserable. But, you know, you just have to keep being as nice as you can, and sometimes, you know, being nice and sort of seeming like you're at their mercy might not help you, so you also have to be very, you know, confident and serious about it, and look like, you know, I know why I'm here, and, you know, I want to see, and be as professional as possible, even though you're being nice. But it's the persistence and sort of like, you know, one time I had to, you know, I was really hot and I had to get a really cold drink, and I thought, well, you know, I've been sitting there, it's hot in there as well. So I bought like three bottles of Coca-Cola and came in there. I was like, oh, I was really thirsty, and I thought if you would like to have a drink. I'm like, oh, that's really nice of you. And, you know, she sort of loosened up a bit, but you just sort of play it by the ear, I think.
Any tactics to these? Not really?
No, I think you just, you know, you have unfailingly polite. You cannot take it personally. And it's, you know, sometimes they take pity on you, you know, and they'll just, you know, and they really just, and they start to feel bad because they start to, you know, oh my God, you've been sitting here for like 2 hours. I am so sorry. You know, like they'll start to empathize. And, you know, so to the extent you can get that. I've also had gatekeepers, even when the person has said, please book this appointment with Louise Walker, who still wouldn't book the appointment. And I'm kind of like, give me a break. Stop. She said it's okay to meet, you know. So, yeah, so there's just, it just really depends. It's such a personality game, you know, it really is. And I don't think there's no tactic that's going to cover all personalities.
And there's a two-stage process that goes on, isn't there? There's getting into the diary in the first place, which I suppose is cause for mini celebration just in and of itself. But then there's the what might happen between getting in the diary and that time of the week actually arising. Because there's no guarantee, is there, that appointments that are heavily penned into a diary.
If there's something's no guarantee that you're going to be it. Yeah. So, so you can. It's like flying to Geneva.
That hopefully is an extreme example of that. But how many, what sort of proportion of your meetings do you think got cancelled or rescheduled?
I think if you whittle it down, like if I look at all the contacts I made, I probably got to speak to a third of the people. And that's including introductions from people who, you know, where their children went to school together and, you know, like personal friends, you know. So they're, so the amount of times you just get no response, I would say, for me, was is pretty high. And it could be, you know, virtue of the kind of organizations I'm dealing with. So I would say I probably got to a third, and I would say probably 50 out of the interviews I got, 50% got rescheduled, like something happened. I had one 2 weeks ago that was a phone interview, you know, had it all booked, da-da-da-da-da. The guy wasn't there. I spent 45 minutes phoning his phone, and then it started to flip into voicemail, so I knew he was there, but on his phone. And then I've, you know, tried to reschedule, and I phoned, and I sent email, and it's nothing, so I've lost the interview. Like, he might come back, you know, I'll hit him again in a couple of weeks out of, you know, guilt, but to see if I can play on that.
That's metaphorically, not literally.
Yeah.
Well, I presume. It might not be.
You know, I try not to take it personally, but sometimes, you know. Yeah, so I think that's, you know, something that was scheduled. And that was actually, my supervisor had met with this man the week before, and he had agreed to meet with me. So, I mean, that, I would say that's a pretty hot contact, you know, and that was something that didn't happen.
But I think this is useful to be forewarned about. If Louise's experience is typical, if on average 2/3 of your initial contacts come to nothing, and then of the 1/3 that are left, at least half of those get rearranged through no fault of your own, then this suggests that you need to be in contact initially with many, many, many more people than you're eventually hoping to interview for your PhD.
On the other hand,
so you have to err on the side
of too many contacts. You should, I mean, you will know your field better, but I also know of people who got a lot of interviews either because of the kinds of organizations or people they were talking to, or the kind of introduction they had. So I know somebody who interviewed diplomats and had, you know, the right entree into that circle, and the doors just flipped open. So I wouldn't, you know, so I think it really, you know, it really depends. Like you were saying, you were in the country at a time that was really sensitive. I was, what I was doing too at the time was very sensitive in the country. So people were, you know, it was just, it was a tough time to be there. People, it was a delicate conversation. So not everyone was open to it. So I think it really, you know, there's a lot of context as well that will, you know, it's a, it depends kind of thing.
How many contacts did you make initially?
Oh, I don't know, like 100, 120, something like that. Like all together, if I really look at it. It's time consuming because that's, you know, emails that are customized, follow-up phone calls, you know, sometimes agendas that are sent, sometimes EA contacts. Like it can, you know, it's so factor that into your own work plan, like in your own timeline.
But you think, Louise, that out of those 120, you're going to get 40 usable interviews from those.
Mm-hmm.
And a PhD where the empirical basis is built upon 40 interviews looks absolutely fine from a methodological perspective. Indeed, to be able to find 40 people that will talk to you makes it look very good from a methodological perspective. So that's probably the sort of target that you'll be aiming for altogether. But obviously, that depends on the sort of research that you're doing and the number of potential contacts, potential interviewees that there are. Anyway, any other questions from anyone? Carlos?
In terms of budget, did you plan how long you were going to be at each time, the period that you went? It seemed very interesting that you had similar experiences.
How long did you go on?
I was only there for a month, and I spent about 3.5 weeks doing interviews between two cities. So I had a smaller scale of interviews that I was hoping to get. I was hoping to get about 25 interviews because I still have to go back for more fieldwork. So I kind of planned everything, my budget and everything around that time.
Yeah, for me, I would have liked to have stayed longer. Like, it was starting, I could see it was starting, but, you know, the waters were starting to part, and I was there for 2 months. But I had to make a financial decision. You know, accommodation in Malawi is actually very expensive. It's the same as a hotel in a North American city, even in some backpackers' places. So, you know, so it's not necessarily some of these places you go, you should look into, like, if you're doing, you know, transportation, safe transportation, you know. So in Malawi, minibuses, they're mechanically difficult. Drivers are off. You want to speak to the driver so that he does not have alcohol in his breath before you get in, because road accidents are the biggest cause of death there, and maiming. And you see these accidents, you know, on the roadside and things. So you need to really think through, yeah, like, how much travel are you going to do in country? Where are you going to stay? How long do you need? So I had to be practical. Like, I sort of had to go, okay, I have enough, and I'll go with it. But had I had my druthers, I would have stayed probably 3 to 4 months.
Elise, your PhD topic is about...
I'm looking at the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. So I was in Geneva talking to, you know, the WHO and UNAIDS and Rollback Malaria and sort of all the UN, UNDP, sort of all the other, and the Global Fund, obviously, Gavi, like all these organizations. And in Malawi, I was talking to local NGOs, government, the National AIDS Commission.
So Malawi is actually your case study then?
Yeah, Malawi is my case study, yeah.
And, I mean, you have two different contexts. On mm-hmm. one side, Geneva, a well-developed country.
Well, one is the global context of the Global Fund, okay. and the other is the country context.
So on the other side, we have Malawi, a developing country. Mm-hmm. And when you compare both countries in terms of making contacts, in terms mm-hmm. of people, how they talk to you and how they treat you. What kind of experiences did you gain during your time?
I think the challenges were similar. Moose and I talked about, in Malawi there is, there was nothing, I needed to be conscious, I was an outsider. I'm white, I'm from a British university, they have a colonial history, they're highly sensitive to their colonial history, you know, do not want to be patronized, you know, there's a real sort of pride there. So I had to be conscious that I was going, and they're studied to death, right? You know, they've got the ninth highest HIV AIDS rate in the world, they're a high-need country. They get a lot of aid, so there's a big expat community there. So they get managed, you know, aided, studied ad nauseum. So I had to be conscious that I was going in there taking, basically. I wasn't making a contribution, you know, to the country or the well-being of its people or, you know, anything like that. So there's a delicacy about that. And there's nothing I can do about, you know, about that in my situation. But I think it served me to be conscious of that. And in some ways, I was reminded, you know, maybe not overtly, but certainly in other ways. I was put in my place. Let's just put it that way.
Louise, you've told me before that one of the sources of surprise that you had when you were in Malawi was that the civil society groups you found more difficult to get them to open up. That you would probably assume.
I didn't get one civil society interview there. And one of the reasons is because they also have they had a dictatorship for a number of years, so they've only been a democracy for 14 years. So it's a very new thing. So civil society is very. Is not a dynamic force. And because I was there at a very sensitive time, people were, and the Global Fund is such a big funder, and these organizations get funding from the Global Fund, there was no way they were going to talk to me about the Global Fund. And even a North American civil society organization, you know, I look at civil society and go, like, civil society, like, you represent me. You know, like, you're all representative. Well, how about, you know, me? So these issues of governance and who's represented. I've had trouble getting on people's calendars in that community.
Have you found the same, Liz?
I found it was easier to work with the system to get interviews with the government people than with civil society. They seem busier, they seem more, oh, I don't have time to talk to you, and there's not that much clarity in terms of, if you walk into the office, everyone just seems to, you know, not have a certain structure to the way they do things. Whereas when I went to ECOWAS office, the Economic Community for West African States, you go there's a reception, there's a register. If your letters come in, they look at the register. Oh, it was received, this person signed it, go to this floor, another register. Okay, wait there, see this person. But you go to the civil society people and there's someone sitting there very busy on the computer checking emails or something like that, or Facebook. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, oh, I think he's stepped out, why don't you wait? And there's just no structure to it. So I found with civil society it was a lot more difficult to speak to them, but they did speak to me. But then they were less interested in a lot of the work, and I think it was because of what I was doing and the fact that they had issues with the assessment process and felt that it was all some government sham and just couldn't be bothered to invest any time talking about it.
I always think this is fascinating, listening to that, because it might be counterintuitive that you might expect before you start that it's the civil society groups that would be more willing to open up to you. That you might think that they would believe that your work might help them to promote their interest, that it might help them to have an additional sense of voice in the discussions. So it really is quite an eye-opener, I think, to hear that it's actually government officials who might be more open to your approaches, even if they suspect that in some sense you won't be doing their bidding for them, but they're still there and willing to talk to you. And that was something that I wasn't expecting.
To follow on from that, did either of you try and interview anyone in the private sector?
Private sector meaning what?
Business?
I did.
For profit?
I did. I couldn't get hold of him. He just wouldn't answer his phone. And when he replied to my email, he said, oh, I'm really busy traveling here and there. So I had to scrap that part. I wanted to get some representation from the corporate governance sort of idea of things from the private sector. And everyone I tried to contact in a busier city than the capital, where it's mostly government and civil society, but people in Lagos tend to be on the move constantly. So it was very difficult to get hold of them. And I didn't try going to their offices or anything, but I just sort of scrapped that this time.
Because that creates problems of its own, Justin, because it's not as though you can go in there and offer them anything back, or certainly not in the sort of language that would instinctively ring bells with them. It's not as though you can go there and say, well, in the interest of better public service, let's just have a dialogue about this. So interviewing people from the business community.
That distinction between the civil society and private sectors, maybe it's quite similar, because often the private sector, there's a purpose, an ultimate purpose for what they do, and you can still speak to their broader interests as well. For example, the private sector, there might be an organisation providing some sort of sanitation works. Countries, you can say, well, my dissertation's about sanitation, in the same way as civil society as well.
Yeah, I didn't, because it's not that germane to what I'm doing. The only the natural relationship with my work would be pharmaceutical industry, and that's its own dissertation. So I'm not going there, because it would just open up things too much.
It's also its own layers of secrecy as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and interestingly, I probably, you know, I mean, I've worked for pharmaceutical, like, you know, I used to be a consultant, so I consulted to pharma, so I would have some entree in there, but it's not a path I choose to go down. But the other plate is consultants. In the health sector, big, basically U.S.-based health specialist consulting firms. One guy, I saw him, so he's privately employed by this consulting company, and his office is in the same building as the IMF. So there's that. So it depends, when I say, what you mean by private sector and how connected it is to your thesis, or sort of where, how you're going to position it.
So?
I'm just wondering when both of you first set out to do your fieldwork. I mean, how far you were into the program, I guess.
Ah, that's a good question.
I went for my fieldwork in March this year, and I started my PhD in January last year, so kind of halfway through. But that's because I have to do two sets of fieldwork. So this was sort of like a setting the foundation and filling in gaps that I knew I would otherwise not be able to get information for.
It's about similar. So I started my Geneva field work in November of... I feel like I'm doing
that
this
would be
for
2 years ago. 2008 you would have started, wouldn't you?
I started 2008, so I started November 2009.
So that's...
Yeah.
Just over a year in both cases.
Yeah.
And I think it makes sense to try to at least lay down the markers for what you want your fieldwork to be about, and to start, if possible, going and talking to people really quite early on, because 1 year into a three-year programme is quite early on. But the fact that you will constantly be bringing in new information that you can bring to bear on your own research means that starting the field work early is usually a good thing. Specifically a good thing, I'm sure, in terms of the type of research that you two are doing. You're both working in an under-researched area where the policy developments are really quite recent. So it's not as though there's an established empirical literature on the topic that you're researching. If there is an established empirical literature, then you will take most of your guidance from that before you go out into the field. And because of that, I think you can probably delay your entry into the field for quite a long time after these two started. But if you're working on a topic where there isn't an established empirical literature, then, as both of you will have found, you just have to find these things out for yourself. And often the only way to do that is to go out there and be in the field. So Moose's story about engaging in exploratory field work as a means of putting down obvious empirical parameters for her own PhD that she can subsequently begin to flesh out. I think that works particularly well for the type of research topic that both of you have.
Simon? I have three questions. And one is about how to get interest of the person whom I'm interviewing. Luis mentioned that you've sent a proposed agenda in the email that you've sent to, but have you ever made any one-pager document so that you can introduce all your...
They won't read it, and they don't care. And I'm not saying that to be cruel, but... They're busy people, so I'm like, if you read the first sentence of my email, I'm good. And even though I send a proposed agenda, like I gave you an example, but somebody who'd actually read it, most people go, I'm really sorry, I haven't had the time. They're not academics, they've got practical work in the world, and that's what they're focused on. So you've got, your job is to... they've come from their meeting where they've just done the budget and they've just done, whatever it is, the prevention strategy for HIV/AIDS in Malawi and da-da-da-da-da, and you've got to kind of take them out of that space, get them really focused very quickly on what you want from them, and extract your information and leave, basically. So that's your job. So I would do things as courtesy and mostly to provide comfort for them, but... people will not read it. Yeah, so.
My second question is, after you finalize your dissertation or thesis, are you going to send up to all the people that you've interviewed?
I'm doing an executive summary, so I will not send them my thesis. About, you know,
they won't read it.
My supervisor is, you know, if they read my thesis, I'm in good shape. I'm doing it as a way of keeping those relationships for future gainful employment. So, and I've had people say to me, "Please, I'm really interested. Please send me your thing." Mm. So I'm going to do a very brief executive summary and also put it on the web and send it to people. Because I also think they should have access.
Sorry?
They should have access to, they should have transparency about how that information was used.
My last question is, I've had an experience of interviewing in a very short time. From my work experience before, and I had an experience that I thought that I should have asked this question to that person, but I didn't, or I forgot to ask them. Did you have that kind of experience? And maybe you went back by emailing them, and then you
could do that?
I had to send a follow-up email one time because I had a really good interview with some professor in the University of Lagos, and you know, we spent all this time walking through the halls and having this conversation and sitting down for a few minutes, and at the end of it, because he had to leave, I felt, you know, there were some other things that I wanted to know. So because he had said, oh, you know, if you have any questions or anything, just email me or give me a call, so I did have to email him and say, can you elaborate more on this particular issue, and it took a couple of weeks, but he did reply. And I think it's, if you've been able to sort of get that kind of relationship, but you have their contact details, and you can always follow up. You know, it could be in your, you know, as part of your thank you, you have a little courtesy email at the end and say, you know, if I have any further questions, are you okay if I, you know, I might send you an email to follow up on certain things when I get back, and just little things like that.
Because sometimes, though, when you hear the offer of, if there's anything else that you want to know, just email me.
Mm-hmm.
What they actually mean is, right, that's it, you've had my time, please don't ever get in touch with me again. But I will go through the motions of saying it more politely.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose, even if you think that they've really said the second thing, even though they've used the words of the first, if there is something else that you were kicking yourself because you forgot to ask, well, there's nothing lost, is there, by sending the email and asking? Because if you don't send the email and ask, well, you're never going to know. The odds are probably that they're just going to delete your email, so you still won't know, but at least you've given yourself just that small chance of getting that extra information. Carlos?
Did you evaluate the possibility of doing focus groups, like to advance more people in terms of... let's say 2, 3, or 10 people at one time, or making surveys apart from the direct interview as a possibility, and if not, why? Probably it depends, of course, on the type of research.
Mm.
But that's just an idea. And did you write in the process? Like, if you already know that's for the chapter, did you follow any technique in terms of your note making already thinking for the chapter, or this is for chapter something?
I fiddled with the idea of doing focus groups because I had one sort of gatekeeper person who had been involved in the assessment process that I was looking at, and he suggested, oh, you know, we could do this thing and arrange these focus groups and all of that, but by the time I got there, I realized logistically it would have been a nightmare to try to get the kind of people that getting information from would be useful in one room would have been a logistical nightmare. And I don't know how long I would have needed to be able to put that kind of thing together.
Mm.
And so I just couldn't do it, risk wasting my time trying to put that together.
I suppose there's an important distinction there between whether you're doing elite interviewing or whether you're trying to get a sense of public opinion.
Mm.
If you're doing elite interviewing, the things that makes them elite and makes them worthy of interviewing in the first place is that they have specialist knowledge.
Mm.
and that you're likely to want to likely to want to play to their ego, to allow them to know that they have this specialist knowledge that you would like to talk to them about, suggesting to those sorts of people, oh, I'm going to bring you into a room with half a dozen other people who I think are your equals, might not go down terribly well. So if you are doing elite interviews, I think it has to be on a one-to-one basis.
Also, focus groups are a very specific methodology. You need a very precise kind of representation. It can't just be anybody. Like, you've got to really, like, your the set that you derive your group from has to withstand certain methodological rigor. So to get that is hard, especially if you're just showing up in a country. You also should have somebody there supporting you, so you shouldn't be in the room yourself. Like, there's just things around, like, to actually, a focus group is not getting a bunch of people in a room and asking questions. There's a lot more that goes into it. So if you get certain people who don't show up,
that's the end of that.
So it's pretty high risk unless you've got something. I did meet a guy while I was in Malawi who was doing his master's dissertation from the University of Edinburgh. And he did, he was in the country 2 weeks and he did two focus groups and he had 10 people in each, because he paid them the equivalent of about a quarter of a year's Malawian salary to show up. And because he had money from the university, and it wasn't a lot of money for us, you know, but if you look at what the GDP in Malawi is, so he had awesome representation. So he basically paid to get the representation. And, you know, in poor countries, are you expecting people to pay for their transport? Are you expecting them to take time away from their family? Like, you have to kind of understand what you're really asking of somebody. So, yeah, so he was really successful, you know, and this was for a 10,000-word dissertation. I was like, you know, talk about nailing it. He had cash.
As everyone writes down the word bribery in their notes, as the key lesson for today. Johanna.
No, I was just thinking on that note, like, I think it's important just to value people's time, even if they're not the elite, because I met a lot of people in Central America, in the countryside, and, like, you know, like, peasant movement type people, or just peasants who are not organized, who've been interviewed by, especially people from North America, it was very close, like, a lot of students go and interview people there, and they've been, like, you know, just feel like their time hasn't been respected. And I went there to do interviews for my MA, and I could sort of feel the backlash of that disrespect of PhD students and MA students who just don't value poor people's time. Yeah, so I think even if you don't have, like, a secretary in a special agenda, doesn't mean that you have a lot of spare time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're taking time away from looking after your children, feeding your family, like, you know, agricultural work, whatever it is, it has a, in some ways, a greater cost to those people.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a serious impact.
Important to think about and to show that respect. And I don't know about bribing people, but definitely paying people's transport.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it's not, I mean... Surveys.
I was trying to joke,
Like, I think it's a serious issue, though, because you find that a lot, actually, or at least in Central America, you find that a lot, that people sort of abuse people's time, I think.
And it's certainly the case if you can incur the cost to get yourself to them, rather than expecting that to happen the other way around, that... that's a level of respect that often people will respond positively to, isn't it? Moose?
I was going to respond to his second question about what you find out and how it fits into your work. I think one of the most important things that I was able to do before I left, and my supervisors were very particular about it, was that whatever questions I was going to ask and what I was going to look for, I knew where it fit into my work. So it wasn't sort of, oh, I'm just waiting to listen, mm-hmm. to hear what they say so I can put it in there. I was also open to the possibility that they would say things that I didn't even expect to hear, or like Louise found out, you find out something that you didn't even think about because you just hadn't heard about it. But when I asked my questions, I knew what information was missing from a particular chapter. I had a sort of framework chapter, mm-hmm. which had so many holes in it because the information just wasn't available online. There were no documents here in this library that would bring that information, and I knew what was missing. And so I went there with questions so that I could get the answers to fill in those gaps. So as soon as I asked the question and random information would come out about certain things, I knew, oh, this is this chapter. And then, because I also thought ahead of the research question, the broader questions that I was going to answer in the future, I could see how, this is something that would lead to further questions later on in a future chapter.
There's an interesting issue of language involved there, though, that you will almost inevitably use the outline structures of chapters that you've already drafted to give yourself some sort of agenda for what you want to find out within the interview. But I think it's important not to go and to ask the questions directly from the academic language of your PhD, because academic language, it's something that those of us who spend our life discussing issues in academic language slip all too comfortably into, but it's an arcane form of language that can be exclusionary to people who don't work day to day in a university environment. One of the more difficult things I've always found when I'm interviewing is to unlearn my own academic language, that the instinct is to express myself when doing academic work in a particular type of language. And I think it's often necessary to unlearn that instinct, because what you don't want to do is talk straight over people's heads. That it's another element of the respect agenda, isn't it? That to be able to show them sufficient respect to get them to open up to you, you need to be talking to them in a language that they're going to understand, and quoting great big long words from obscure academic tracts is not the way to go about having that level of engagement. So I've always struggled with that in the past. It might say something specific about me. Did you two have that sort of problem? Look, they're just going to say no. It's all
I'm not very
fun.
Good with academic language. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Myself.
Well, that's one way of solving that particular problem, isn't it?
I don't understand most of it myself. So.
I just asked, very basic questions, and I let them do the talking. I didn't try to sound like I knew because at the end of the day, they're telling me stuff that I don't know. So I asked the question, like a very as simply as I can. I forgot all about my theoretical framework when I was there. Like, that doesn't exist. Just ask very straightforward questions and just let them speak, and encourage them to speak and just probe things here and there. But most of the time, just let them do the talking. You'd be surprised how much they want to express themselves if they are open to the idea.
This is actually one of my small fears or whatever, undergoing the process of doing a PhD. After working for a while and building networks in different areas, I realised I'm having to learn a whole new constructivist framework to analyse something that I feel I already understand. There's a new language around it. And now that I've started talking to people about what my PhD topics are, I'm starting to make less sense.
Yeah.
I'm actually worried about it. I don't want this to happen. And I'm trying to sort of take a step back from the reading I'm doing and do it cursory sort of way to keep that real world perspective. So.
It's a double translation difficulty,
yeah.
Isn't it? That you accidentally get yourself caught up in.
Yeah.
So don't tell those people anything about linked ecologies, I think.
Exactly.
That's the key insight, isn't
that
it?
That was when the penny dropped when I started using it in a normal conversation.
Because I said that was one of my big problems when I'd been interviewing. You two might remember this from a couple of years ago, that my actual biggest problem was always being allowed to remain in the interview room. I do have the wonderful moment on record when I got thrown out of the Prime Minister's office while doing an interview, his personal office at number 10 Downing Street. Unfortunately, I didn't get thrown out of number 10 Downing Street, which would have been even more impressive. especially because at the exact time that I was being thrown out of the Prime Minister's private office, Peter Mandelson was outside in Downing Street resigning live on the TV cameras. So it could have been somebody holding me by the collar and just throwing me out at exactly that moment, captured forever on TV. But unfortunately, they only allowed you to exit 10 Downing Street if you had the policeman at the door escorting you out. So I had to go downstairs and wait in the holding room, which is the waiting room just inside the door. And that had all arisen because I was doing some interviews with two colleagues for a research project that we were working on at the time. My colleagues from Birmingham at that time, Colin Hay and Daniel Wincock, you might have heard of them. And we decided before we went in that we would play distinctive roles in the interviewing process there. Dan would be the person who wouldn't say a great deal, but would always try to change the nature of the conversation to take it on to the topics that we wanted to talk about, almost as if to try to catch out the person that we were interviewing from the Prime Minister's private office, if that person had clearly slipped into a script. Mm. If he was clearly just giving us the standard high rhetoric, low information response that you could read anywhere in any government outlet, then that was Dan's job. Colin's job was to be the passive, nice, polite person who would re-ask the questions when the interviewee was caught unawares. And my job was to be the rabble-rouser, to try to be deliberately a little bit rude to see whether I could poke him into saying one or two things that he might not have wanted to say. And this seemed to be working really well until about two-thirds of the way through our allotted time with him. He took a complete disliking to me for probably understandable reasons given the nature of my role, and not only requested but demanded that I leave the room immediately, and he had to ring one of the security people to come and pick me up and take me down to the waiting room. Now I tell this story not only because it's actually, I still count that as the highlight of my interview, not the highlight. And it's funny how you could put either characterisation onto it. But there was something noticeable there, that when there were three of us doing a joint interviewing, we were able to formulate a distinct division of labour and to accept that we each had different roles in the process. Whereas what Louise and Moose were talking about, and I thought this came across very clearly, was the number of different roles that you have to play all at the same time. Then you're politely using your listening skills as a way of trying to tease them out to say something. You're also scribbling down notes to make sure that you haven't missed anything. You've got the framework of your PhD in the back of your mind, and you're asking questions on that basis as well. So you've got multiple agendas and you're playing multiple roles all at the same time. This is clearly very difficult. Is there any way that you can prepare yourself for that, or do you just have to go with the flow once you're in there?
Well, you can't. I guess because each interview is so different, you just sometimes have to go with the flow. But if, as long as you're very, very clear on what you want to get out of it, you know, so you have very specific things you want to find out, and you need to know the things that you must find out, you know, because you could have an interview for 30 minutes and they can talk about a lot of useful things that are useful in one way or the other, but that might not be the specific thing that you're out to get. So as with the other extra things that you get, you want to get what you're there for. So that question you ask has to be answered in one way or the other, and then some other things thrown in, you know. So it's just having a very clear idea of what you're out to get from the interview and just playing it by the ear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say before the interview, assume you only have 10 minutes and know what you're going to get. You need to get in that 10 minutes. If you get an hour and a half, bonus, because, you know, you'll have tons of questions. But really,
be clear, like, what's the minimum requirement you have to get if you only have 10 minutes with this person.
Did you find that there was a role-playing element to the interview, though, and that you would... Everyone's laughing, huh?
No, just because you were talking about your role-playing. It's very much role-playing.
Yeah, and that worked, didn't it? But what I meant by that was in terms of that you would almost present yourself and your interests and your position differently depending on who you were talking to.
I guess for me it was because one time I had to go to the secretariat of the mechanism I was studying and talk to the guy who was the director of this thing. And, you know, it was different from talking to civil society people who kind of placed themselves opposed to this thing and felt like they had been used by the government to get information and then discarded because, you know, they're just civil society. So I kind of felt like the civil society people wanted me to show that I was on their side, or I was more interested in their perspective than the perspective of the government. And it's difficult to sort of not give too much about what you're doing, because I didn't feel the need to explain what my thesis was about to any of these people. You know, I just said, well, this is generally what I'm doing, and this is why I'm here. I tried not to give too much information about maybe the core of my argument or, you know, what perspective I'm taking with the people in government and with civil society. Sometimes it's a bit tricky. You have to not be caught out trying not to give too much information. I can't really explain, but it depends on the personality of the person you're speaking. Some of them are very straightforward about, so what exactly are you doing with this information, or, you know, where are you going with this?
I ask the question because when I've interviewed on my own, I've always thought that it was probably sensible to construct my questions in a way that would allow the interviewee to infer that I was perhaps sympathetic to their position and sympathetic to their role. So I would find that I would be asking the same question almost from different angles and different normative perspectives, depending on who it was that I was talking to. I don't know whether that actually goes against some of the generic rules of research ethics, where you're meant to be as open and as honest as possible. But those rules themselves, I think it's easy to write them down, and it's much more difficult to abide by them very, very strictly when you're in that pressure cooker situation of the interview process itself. Because you're responding to so many different things all at one time, it is very difficult to know exactly where the boundaries between correct and incorrect behaviour are. Because the thing that you want to respond to most, obviously, of course, is the conversation. Because you want to allow them to feel that they are involved in a fairly normal conversation. So it's probably not a good idea to fire one question at them and then generate the opening of a genuine dialogue with them over that question, and then just stop completely asking about that and ask about something that's entirely different. So there is always that trade-off as well, that Louise is absolutely right, that there are your priority questions that you must ask at some stage. But if you can ask them in the process of giving the impression to your interviewee that this is just a normal conversation that's developing along normal lines, then that probably is the goal to aim for. To what extent did you two go in with prepared lists of questions? Because the guidance books on this are very much split. Some of them will tell you that you have to go in fully memorised all the questions that you want to ask, and you must ask them in exactly the form that you've written them down on your list. And some say that you should go in with a general sense of the broad areas that you want to explore, but you should let the conversation develop as naturally as possible.
I am probably in between those things. So I had a very, you know, I had an agenda that I used for every single meeting. But I would choose to emphasize certain aspects of the agenda, depending on who I was talking to, just because, you know, I wanted to take advantage of somebody's experience or expertise or get a perspective of an organization. So I would work through pretty much a thematically a standard list of questions, and then emphasize certain things more than others. You know, and in some cases it doesn't make sense to ask them. There's certain questions it just doesn't make sense to ask the person, you know. So I mean, you can't sort of, you got to be intelligent, you know, about what you're doing. But mostly I wanted to do that because I wanted to have empirically from different organizational I wanted to have different organizational perspectives on the same sort of theme or question. So when I could write it up, I would be in a good position to say, you know, this is commonly agreed to or understood, or this is contentious and here's why, or, you know, so if you think through to how you're going to use the information, you know, you want support for certain of your own research questions and you want to get the perspective. So so you can't make it too, too sort of, you know, what do you want to chat about today?
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's also times where they'll start to say something and you'll think, I don't understand what that means, or, you know, could you explain that a little bit more? And you'll find out, you know, like sort of avenues will open up that you didn't, you know, things I didn't understand before. I may have heard them before, but it just didn't impress me as being as important as it turned out to be, or, you know, things like that, that you sort of, so subsequent interviews, I might, you know, refocus a little bit and say, well, what about this kind of thing? And then all of a sudden they would have a lot, you know, I'd be like, oh, this is good. You know, so you sort of like, oh, you know, you find a vein kind of, and you sort of follow it, but it was still on the same, like thematically, I was pretty disciplined.
I had a similar thing. I had certain questions that I wanted to ask, and I was asking to two different sites. So it was basically the same question, getting their perspectives on it. But as Louis said, you know, sometimes you ask a question, you hear something, and then you realize you've heard it from two or three people, you know, and then you might decide to just ask a specific question about that thing to someone who you feel might be able to, might be in a position to explain it better using their own level of expertise. And but definitely having a clear set of questions at the back of your mind, not reading the script. You know, because it is important to be as natural as possible and make them feel comfortable. And I was going to say, it's also, I don't know if we've gotten to that part yet, but knowing when to stop, I found that I got to a point where I was having interviews with, especially with the civil society people, and I thought, well, I wanted to get as many interviews as I could while I was still there. So for every day I was still there, I thought, okay, I should do at least a certain number of interviews, but I was hearing the same thing over and over and over, you know, in different ways, and I thought, okay, you know, maybe I can take the rest few days before I leave and just have a break. You know, I've heard it all at this point, and then I'm not going to hear anything new. But, you know, I guess the important thing is, especially if you have sort of an open time to be there, if you want to be there for a month or 2 months or something, and you get to a certain point where you've spoken to all the people that you feel are very important to speak to, all the key people you need to speak to, it's just kind of knowing, oh, is it okay to stop now? Because you might keep getting contacts, you know, the snowballing might keep going on, but trying to figure out when to stop, I'm not sure how to. In my case, I knew that I could stop there and then because I knew I was going back,
but
it might be something you might have to think about, maybe decide with your supervisors when they think you should stop.
It's a really important question. Do you have any advice, Louise? Because I'm not sure that I have any sense that there was a generic answer as to when to stop.
I think, like Moo said, you do get to a point where you're hearing, you could pretty much predict what the answers are going to be. So the question becomes, why are you interviewing this person? Do you need to show in your bibliography that you have a particular sector or organization, or like, do you need to have something covered basically so that you're you know, you're just well defended. So an examiner isn't going to say, well, how can you make these claims if you haven't spoken to da 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 da. So, you know, so I think you have to say, you know, have I, you know, be clear what your requirements are to have defensible research. And if you've met them, you've met them, you know, and move on, because, you know, you got to write a thesis. Like, you know, this isn't all about field work. So at some point, I think you do have to make a practical decision about, you know, is this, am I really going to get exponentially more by staying, by doing more interviews, or do I need to get on with the ugly business of writing?
I think most people will be guided by those sorts of criteria. That most field work takes place within the parameters of a defined trip that has a potential life that you can't go beyond. Often it will be the return plane ticket that will tell you when the trip will end, and also within the defined parameters of a particular amount of money that you have to spend on the fieldwork trip. And I guess it's usually the case that most people work up to the point at which the trip itself reaches its natural limits, and then they come back. So if that means that you are finding yourself hearing the same thing over and over again in the last few days, the temptation is always just to work until the end point of the trip. Whether that's helpful or not, that's a different question, I guess. But then you're never going to know that it wouldn't have been helpful unless you've actually conducted those last few interviews. Because there's always the possibility in the back of your mind that even if the last five or six have said the same thing, that the seventh one might tell you something that's particularly insightful and that can help you. So there's always that nagging doubt at the back of your mind about the possibility of doing more. But I don't think that that doubt should really play too highly in your mind. That in general, PhD examiners are impressed with any field work that's been done, especially if the field work itself is clearly shown within the PhD to be fundamental to the findings that the PhD delivers. So if there is a well-reasoned and good justification for doing the field work, and the field work itself is generative of the findings, then PhD examiners are almost always going to be very impressed that you've been able to do that degree of field work. They are unlikely to question you about why didn't you interview X or Y. They might possibly do so, but only if they are a real, real specialist on that particular policy area. So it depends in that respect on how you set your PhD up and the claims about contribution that you want to make about your own PhD. If your contribution is expressed in terms of generating in-depth empirical knowledge about that particular policy process, then you might be more likely to get that sort of question than if you set your PhD up saying that this is an illustrative case study that helps you to reflect more broadly on a set of issues that are derived from theory. So that goes back to what we were discussing a number of weeks ago about how important it is for you to set your PhD up and to describe your contributions in a way that actually matches the subsequent work that you've done within your PhD. Any more questions from people about the process of interviewing? Because we seem to be talking now about what you do when you're actually in there, in the room with people. No questions at all? One or two last pieces of advice. In fact, one last question to Louise and Moos. Did you ever find yourself citing the response from one interviewee to another interviewee as a way of maybe trying to tease them out to get them to be more open?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I've always found that that works really quite well.
Mm-hmm.
As a strategy.
And well, it's truthful. You know, I mean, you can. It's truthful to say, you know, I've heard a number of times that such and such and such and such has been a challenge. Do you share that perspective or, you know, whatever it is? Like, I think it's perfectly, and it shows that it gives you, it makes you look less naive, you know, or less sort of, you know, you just fell off the potato truck kind of thing. Yeah, so, you know, like it's sort of like, because you're starting to use the language that they're familiar with.
Yeah.
You're starting to reflect to them issues that they're struggling with. So, yeah, I think it's a great way to ingratiate yourself without, you know, not with genuinely, you know, not as, not to be manipulative.
And it helps you to come across as sounding as though you are authoritative. On that particular question, if you're able to cite people that your current interviewees may be likely to see as their equals in some respect. But also remember that you can use this to your advantage by playing to their sense of ego somewhat as well. That they might see these people as their equals, but they also might not want to defer to them to see them as their hierarchically superior in some sense. So if you can say that interviewee such and such said such and such, what do you think about this? They probably won't want to be outdone. They will want to be able to show that they can express an opinion and an opinion that they will present to you as being equally as valid as the one that you can cite back to them from your other interviewee. What did you wear when you went to did you dress up smartly for your interviews? These are some basic questions, which actually are quite important.
Yeah,
you should reflect.
You had the business suits on, did you?
No, well, in Geneva I did, because that's the environment I was in. So I was meeting people in smart suits. And it helps me, you know, it's then they respect me. I'm not schlumping in looking like, you know, a student. In Malawi, I wore, well, first of all, you know, you got to dress for weather. So I actually only had one interview suit because I, you know, I had a backpack. So there's only so much you can, you know, pack on your back. But I just wore like a skirt and a t-shirt and a sweater. In some cultures, I made sure the skirt was a certain length because it's inappropriate. So there are different, especially for women, there are different cultural sensitivities about lengths of skirts, how much arm skin you show, whether or not you show your shoulders, definitely no cleavage, you know, those types of things, not too much makeup, not, you know, but those things are actually, can be very offensive. You should be as modest as possible, and I think it's very important to do that, because it's, if you're not, it can just be, in that environment, appear shocking. You know, what we would just go, you know, would be nothing, in that environment can appear very shocking, and you don't want to inadvertently do that.
The main insight is to dress appropriately, isn't it? Depending on
but
who it
think
is
ahead, right? I mean, think it, like, know the culture you're going into.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, I also didn't wear jewelry because I also took public transit a lot, and so, you know, I would often have my jewelry touched and things like that, and it's just, I just felt it made me stand out too much. Apart from all the obvious ways, but
So it is a case, I think, that if you're doing elite interviewings, the business suit might be the most appropriate thing to wear.
Or a professional, like something professional.
Something
professional.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, I would definitely, like a man would wear, may not have to wear a tie, but a jacket with a collared shirt, that kind of thing.
But we have a PhD student in the second year now who's doing participant observation research with anti-war and anti-arms trade groups in the UK. And you can imagine that if he turned up wearing a suit to some of those meetings, he would be excluded straight away.
Yeah.
So there are important rules there.
You should reflect the culture of the environment you're in.
Yeah.
I had to go to the, I think it was the National Institute for Islamic something. It was one of the associations for that, and the person who was taking me said, bring a scarf, you know.
Mm.
I mean, I was just wearing a shirt that was always buttoned up and not that much, I wasn't wearing makeup or fancy jewelry or anything, but he said, you know, make sure you bring a scarf when you go to this place. And you know, it's just sometimes you might need to sort of amend your dress code depending on where you're going on that specific day.
Mm.
But
anything else before we wrap it up? No, there's no more questions. We seem to have exhausted our questions and probably exhausted you two as well. And so clearly the last thing for me to do is to thank Louise and Moose on everyone's behalf for coming and talking today, and I think we should do that in the usual manner.